You can now take KRBN Internet News Talk Radio with you on your mobile phone, as we are making it easier to listen to the great hosts here on KRBN, including our very own West Lane County Commissioner, Jay Bozovich. It's free and available on Google Play. Just look for player.fm. That's player.fm and search for KRBN.
Live from Lane County, Oregon, it's the Boz Knows Show with your host, West Lane County Commissioner, Jay Bozovich. And now, here's Jay.
And good afternoon. It's another beautiful day here in Pacific Northwest, and this is the Boz Knows Show, and I'm your host, West Lane County Commissioner Jay Bozovich, coming to you live from beautiful downtown Elmira, Oregon. And today we have a guest on the Boz Knows Show. We have Bob Snedden, the former news director and on-air personality at KCST Coast Radio in Florence. Bob, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
I bet it's a little bit different. I've been on your show, and now this, I get to interview you for a change. Is it make you nervous to be the interviewee?
No, actually it doesn't, because I'm just happy to be in a conversation and upright.
Yep, well, that's great. Well, I just want to remind folks, if they want to ask Bob a question or me a question, they can call into the show at 646-721-9887 and press 1, and that lets my call screener Robin know that you want to get in on the show. So again, that's 646-721-9887 and press 1, and that lets Robin know you want to get in on the show. So Bob, I wanted to start out with just how you ended up getting into radio and news in the first place. I mean, did you grow up in Florence? And then how'd you end up at KCST?
I did grow up in Florence, and I've done a couple different things here in town. And I've known John Thompson, the owner and general manager of Coast Radio, since they went on the air in 88. And had done a few commercials and stuff. And he needed a host for the monthly community forum program. And that was in, I think, about 99, 98, somewhere in there. And so I started doing that, plus working on Saturdays, just kind of a little spare time stuff. And then a couple of years later, his news director left, and he had an opening in a position, and he offered it to me. It was a good fit.
Great. So that it was kind of just knowing the owner of the radio station. You know, what were you doing before you started that part-time job? What was your job then?
Well, I was selling insurance for 7 years. I worked with Able Insurance Agency, and before that, I had what I call the lost decade, where I was in the car business. And a lot of folks in Lane County may remember Uncle Bud Chevrolet in Cottage Grove, and I was Uncle Bud's very last employee way back in 1991. So.
Yeah. Hmm. Okay, so I've done
a variety of things. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But you didn't go to school for journalism or, you know,
no,
to be in media.
No,
or,
as a matter of fact, the news part was the biggest challenge for me early on, because I had no formal training in that. But I had been a very busy and active consumer of radio for many, many years. I would rather listen to a baseball game or a football game on the radio than watch it on TV. And same way with, I would rather listen to talking heads sometimes. I listen to a lot of podcasts, and not so much on opinionated talk radio, but I would rather listen to people talking about different subjects rather than even music sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. I've done similar. Got into the audio books while I was doing some indoor paint. You know, it's just much rather sometimes, you know, listen to some of those, especially really well done audio books. So I get that.
I've been involved in a lot of things in the community over the years too, and I think that helped me connect with from the news standpoint. I was on the Planning Commission in Florence for a total of about 12 years over two different stints. I was a volunteer firefighter in the community for 27 years, and Chamber of Commerce, and all kinds of different things. So I was not the shrinking violet, I think, that some people may think I am.
Yeah. Which, you know, kind of got you, you know, those contacts and being familiar with the community, I guess, helped out with that community forum program when he first hired you to do.
Right. That helped, because I made a lot of contacts, and I've never was bashful, and you probably will attest to this, I was never bashful about calling somebody and just saying, hey, this is Bob, and I have a couple questions I'd like to ask you about this or that, or would you come talk to me? So just reaching out and knowing who to call. Sometimes it's a little bit of a challenge to develop some leads and contacts, but once you get the list of people to call, it's a little easier.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I remember the first time I think I was on the radio with you was when I was running for Lane Community College Board, and you had a candidates forum down there that brought you broadcast live on KCST, and you were the moderator.
I did a lot of those over the years. Yeah, as a matter of fact, my last. Not really my last, because I'm still doing like football games and high school basketball games and stuff like that. But in May, I did a candidates forum down here. There were a lot of contested races for fire and ambulance and different boards and school board and stuff. And so that was one of my last things I did. That was my last Our Town program that I hosted. And it was a special 3-hour show at the Florence Event Center. And, yeah. It's interesting. It's always a lot of fun.
Yep. Yeah, and that was an interesting election cycle for Florence. You know, the May election wasn't too big in a lot of areas of Lane County, but Florence sure had its share of issues going. It seemed like, you know, if you were just to look at the ballot and didn't understand what was going on in the background, it might not have seemed so apparent, but things like the port commissioners and the fire district and ambulance district boards had a lot of background issues going behind, you know, which candidates were supporting which initiatives, et cetera, really those races.
Right. And, you know, the longtime familiarity with all the players and in the community and the history made it easier to understand some of those issues. And my challenge over the years is always how to translate that understanding so that other people can share that knowledge and understanding as well.
It's always kind of interesting. I approach this program somewhat the same way I have to always remember the average person's not as plugged in as I am. And probably the same thing as you covered news, you know, for 16 mm-hmm. years, basically, down there in Florence. They don't get all the nuances. They don't know who all the players are and what the background issues. And it's being able to bring those out to the public in a way they can understand, and remembering that the public doesn't have the background knowledge. It's kind of important in radio. You know, and it's kind of why it makes radio a great medium to listen to, because it, just like football games and baseball games are far better, I think, on the radio than they are to watch on TV. It's all that explanation that a radio person without the pitcher has to do that makes radio seem so vibrant. Yeah.
Yeah. And I talked to a lot of people who were deep in the throes of some of the governmental issues and technocrats, I maybe would refer to them, some of them, sometime, and there are always a lot of acronyms, and that was one of the things I always tried to do. And somebody would drop a few acronyms or a shorthand term for something, I would make them stop and explain what that was, because not everybody listening would understand that. I know when I'm listening to somebody and they use a term that I don't understand, I always appreciate it when somebody takes the time to explain what that is. So.
Yeah. So was there a favorite example of an acronym somebody dropped on the air that you remember?
Oh, man, there are so many favorite acronyms everywhere. That's a really good question, Jay. I'm going to, you know, sometimes when they're dealing with legislative issues, especially, or zoning issues, but, I mean, I would hear people refer to, you know, a lot of times when it dealt with budgeting and staffing issues, some budget people, whether it's a school district or a government agency, would say, well, that gives us 12.5 FTE. And I'd have to say, well, what does that mean? What is, you know, and well, FTE, a full-time equivalent. And they were basically talking about staffing and employees at that point. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I can't think of any off the top of my head, but, yeah.
Yeah, FTE is a pretty common one used by us budget geeks, yeah.
Yeah, and you hear that all the time in that setting. But for most people who don't go through, sit in on budget processes, they may not know exactly what that means. You know?
Yeah.
And each different government agency or political subdivision has their own nomenclature, whether it's if you're dealing with a school issue or you're dealing with county, city, or state, or one of the special districts, and they have their own special language and acronyms and abbreviations that they know what they're talking about, and sometimes they lose sight of the fact that just the common ordinary Joe has no clue what they're saying.
ODOT seems to have a language all to itself.
There's an acronym right there.
Yep. But most people know ODOT's or the Department of Transportation.
Yes, yes. Fortunately or unfortunately, there's a lot of people know what ODOT is now these days.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. And they do have their own language. Yeah.
The one that probably got me the most was I started to serve on the local public safety coordinating council, which is a statutorily required organization and meant to coordinate community corrections money from the state, and also now deals with justice reinvestment monies. But you want to talk about a group full of acronyms when you get a bunch of folks that are dealing with some of these programs from the state. They all refer to them not even by the letters, but by some, you know, word that sounds like what the letters are, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one kind of an example of that here in the Florence area, several years ago, there was a consortium of public safety agencies, and not all of them were public safety, just some of them were public agencies. They decided, and it was a great effort, they decided to come together and do some long-range planning and preparation for disaster preparedness. And the earthquake and tsunami issues kind of prompted the whole thing. And the group got together, and they formed a bureaucratic name, and it's the Westlane Emergency Operations Group. And the acronym, the handle they gave to it was WELOG. And I dare say that for probably the first 10 to 12 years of existence, most people in the community had no idea, A, that it even existed, and B, what WELOG meant. But they've been doing really good work over the past few years, and they've been advertising what their purpose is, because that's one of the main purposes of the group, I believe, is to make sure people are aware of disaster preparedness. But that's an example of how you can get into the bureaucraties and talk about things, and you really have to know the language.
The first time I saw WELOG and heard that term, I was kind of like, what's that group? And is that a county group? Or, you know, it was explained to me later on, but yeah, had that same thing happen. So I imagine in the news, you've come across a lot of acronyms and a lot of different agencies and all that.
Yeah.
And I imagine you've gotten to cover a lot of real personal stories there in the Florence area.
Yeah, you know, I've seen a lot of changes in the community, and I think some of the things that made it easier for me in the long run to do that job, I did it for 16 years, was the fact that I had sat in many of the positions or experienced many of the things that the people I was talking with, what they were doing. I had been there and done a lot of that. You know, I served on the Planning Commission, in the late 80s here in Florence, and then again through the mid-90s, during times of some pretty active development. And so I, you know, when I go to talk to somebody who's on a city council or you know, staff member at City Hall or somebody who's on a planning commission, I know what they're dealing with. And I like to think that gave me a little bit of an advantage, because when I'd ask a question, I knew what I was talking about because I'd experienced it or I had enough understanding of it. And they all expressed appreciation for that sort of thing, and it allowed them to, I could ask an intelligent question, and they could give a really good response that way. And likewise, there was times I could ask a question, and I didn't get a very good response, and that made it a little awkward at times. But it, you know, part of my job was to let people know what was going on, and if they really thought the people that were running things or running for things would be able to do a good job. So, and sometimes it gave those officials kind of a wake-up call where they would make some changes. I mean, there were many times I sat in meetings and I would get a question from the staff or the elected officials about, is this how we're supposed to do this? Or what should we do here? And there were a couple times when I spoke up at meetings and unfortunately had to remind folks of the open meetings laws and what they were talking about or considering doing did not necessarily qualify or meet the criteria that set out in Oregon law. They, you know, maybe sometimes it's human nature not to want to talk about difficult things in public. And so there were times when they would do that. And that's why the press is there. One reason why the press is there is to sit in and say, hey, listen, you know, I saw my role as not say, hey, you guys can't do this, but I saw my role. And a couple times, particularly when I said, just want to let you guys know that I don't believe the conversation you just had is covered under the executive session portion of the open meetings law. And I just want to let you know that I will be reporting on this tomorrow. Because it's not my job to make them do it right, but it was my job to say, hey, if you're not doing it right, this is what I'm going to report on it. So.
Yeah.
And there were a couple times when a public meeting, and it was mostly just inadvertent, because they'd had maybe a staff member who just did things automatically, and maybe that staff member wasn't available or was no longer there, but there were a couple times during the budget season especially where they'd have a budget committee meeting. One agency, I saw that, they had a budget committee meeting, and then they adjourned the meeting and said, okay, we're going to reopen a board meeting here. And I said, well, but you haven't advertised for one. And a couple of the board members expressed surprise that they were having a board meeting also. And the answer I got was, well, we've always done it this way. And my response was, well, you may have always done it this way, but you had somebody who was in charge of making sure that it was published and the public had adequate notice. So in that case, they said, okay, we won't have a meeting. So,
pretty funny. So you've probably witnessed several different mayors of Florence, a couple different county commissioners for West Lane, probably a couple score of city councilors and far more port commissioners, fire district board members, school board members, and all that stuff. Do you have
particular?
I was going to ask if you, particular elected official that kind of sticks in your head for, you know, for one reason?
Well, there are two that I'd rather not talk about publicly than stick in my head. I did. I went through, I think, six Florence city managers, six Isla school districts, probably four Mapleton school or school superintendents, four mayors, because we had one mayor, Phil Brubaker, that served for a good long time through there. And, of course, Joe Henry is in his second term right now, I think. There are a few officials, and I will Roger Bennett, who was a Florence city manager for about 5 years, 15 years ago to about 10 years ago, he stands out as one who brought a level of professionalism. And his predecessor, and I can't recall his name, was a good city manager, but Roger just brought a whole nother dimension to it and started what I saw as the renaissance in Florence city government that took a few years, but it morphed and progressed. And right now I think Florence city government is the most transparent of any I've ever seen, and the most dialed into the community. And I really think Roger started that. And he also started the process of looking within for key positions. And I saw that work well in the manager's position. I saw that work at the school district, when looking within to fill some key positions there. The current superintendent, Andy Griskowiak, is, I think he's doing an outstanding job. He's dialed into the community and gets it, that, you know, we don't run and hide from the press. And his predecessor, Ethel, was the same way. And that, I can't say that of all school superintendents I've dealt with. A lot of times you would get educationalese or, well, I can't talk to you about that, or just nice. Sometimes you know when you're getting platitudes and people's giving you a spiel, and it's a stump speech almost, and they're not really telling you anything other than just generalities, and it gives you the impression that they're hiding something. They're not most of the time, but that's the way it comes across. And Ethel and Andy Griskowiak at the school district, current city manager, is doing, Aaron Reynolds is, you know, some of it's because maybe I've developed a pretty good relationship, and so they're open with me. And they're not afraid to speak frankly and clearly, because they also know I understand and I can filter some of that stuff. I don't take it verbatim and give them a quote. I'm not looking for a sensational quote. I'm looking to get information and make sure people understand what's happening in the community and how it affects them. So I talk a lot sometimes too.
And I appreciated, you know, my interviews with you, and when we did a quick phone interview here and there throughout the years, to get a reaction to, or a quote on a particular story. You weren't looking for the sensational, which I always appreciated. You were really looking for information to give out to the folks in the Florence area. So, kind of steering a little bit away from government, you probably covered a lot of personal stories and human interest stories. What are some of the most, you know, moving stories you remember covering?
Oh, wow. You know, there's always the stories of the tragedies, the accidents, stuff like that. But one of my favorites, and I kind of get choked up talking about it, and I cannot remember the young man's name. I'll go through my list of awards and certificates that I got, because I actually won a story from an award from Associated Press on it. There was a young boy, I think he was about 5 years old, and he was camping with family friends up at Washburn State Park, and he wandered away. He was just playing. He wandered away from the campsite, like, you know, late afternoon, early evening, and they spent that evening looking for him in the woods outside Washburn Park, and they finally called in search and rescue. And it wasn't until the next morning, maybe early afternoon, almost 24 hours after being gone, they found him safe. He just, you know, and that little kid had covered a lot of ground, a lot of it straight up and straight down through some heavy underbrush, and they finally found him about a mile and a half away from the campground. But it generated a lot of attention statewide, and you know, a lot of concern. But I covered that story, and I was able to cover it quickly, and I fed stuff to AP in Portland, and I fed, of course, they had stuff on the air here in town, and it was, you know, that was a story with a really, really happy ending. Unfortunately, didn't always see stuff like that.
Yeah, but I imagine it while it was, they hadn't found him yet, talking with the parents and relatives must have been very emotional.
Yeah, it was pretty tough, and talking with some of the searchers, and, you know, everybody was optimistic, but and the kid just vanished without a trace. And, you know, first they locked down the campground and wouldn't let any other vehicles in or out, and they searched every vehicle in the campground. And then they finally just realized that you know, it was not too far to the highway, so they were afraid that he had made his way to the highway and somebody had picked him up. But he went cross country, and I tell you what, and he was a pretty tough kid. But he was a little hungry and cold and tired by the time they got him, too. But I've covered my favorite stories were the good ones that I liked. I like to shine some light on things, and I'm drawing a blank on some of them. But you know, sometimes how the community would come together after certain things that would go on. Maybe it was an accident, somebody was severely injured, or maybe a death or a fire or something like that. And just how the community, once they got a hold of something like this and learned about it, just what they did to come together to support other people in the community. Those were the stories. And I can think of three or four just right off the top of my head where I saw that happen. And it was good. It was fun to be involved in that as we went along. And it was also very satisfying. One particular one, I'll tell you, Kaylee Graham and the Power of Florence here in Florence, which was just a week and a half ago here in town on the 15th, third Saturday in July, when Kaylee was, I don't know, 11, 12 years old. She told her mom she wanted to have a garage sale to help raise money for the food share or something like that, I can think it was. And her mom said, well, why don't you think of something bigger? So she brainstormed, and she just put together a day of volunteering. And this kid, she went to the city council, got a resolution, she got it organized, the whole thing, and she got dozens of groups and individuals together to all do, everybody would get the idea was that on the third Saturday in July, all these people would go do something good for somebody else. And it's gone on, I think this was the sixth year here, and Kaylee is moving on because she's done with high school, and she's passed it on to I can't remember the young girl's first name, Glowacki is her last name, and she's going to take it on, and hopefully it's going to be a tradition that continues here in Florence. But it was all started because the kid said, hey, I want to help somebody out. So we got everybody involved.
Yeah, and I remember talking with Kaylee that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember talking with
some
Kaylee
of the fun things.
First.
Yeah. Our little lag and delay is a little awkward sometimes. So if I walk over you, several of the things that we got involved in when I was working full time with the radio station, my favorite things to do was the, you know, the classic car cruise on Roadie Festival weekend. I organized and put that together for many years, and that's always a lot of fun to do that and see the same people in the same cars every year come through, and looking around in Old Town Florence, especially with the number of people who would look forward to that event and come down and watch the old cars And you know, I had just one small part in it because the firefighters would do a lot, and all the people that owned the cars would do an awful lot of work, and I got to sit in the middle and talk about it, and it was just a lot of fun to do that. The annual drive-in movie that we did here in Florence, unfortunately, we're not going to do anymore because just logistically it isn't working out. But we, Miller Park used to be a drive-in movie theater here in Florence. And the guy whose family used to own and operate it, along with Harbor Theater many, many years ago here in town, called me one time, and he said, "Hey, Bob, I want to bring the Rhododendron Drive-In back for one night." And this was about 6 years ago, and so we put it together. It was going to be just a one-time deal. We'd put up a temporary screen. He would bring a high-powered projector down, and we would project a movie on the screen, and people would sit in their cars in Miller Park and watch the movie. Well, it was such a big response that we did it a total of six times. The screen and the projector that we had available for it, it's all professional quality stuff, was no longer available. So unfortunately, last September was the last one we got to do. But that was always a lot of fun because there'd be, 300-400 people would come in and sit in their cars and watch the drive-in movie for one night.
Yeah, well, I'm old enough to remember having gone to a drive-in theater with my parents where they had us in the back seat in our pajamas of the station wagon, with the seats down and a mattress down there so we could fall asleep watching That Darn Cat from Walt Disney.
Yeah.
At the drive-in movie theater.
My wife and I, way back in 1979, that was our first date, was the Rhododendron Drive-In here in Florence, and it was The Seven Voyages of Sinbad and Alien. I can still remember the movie. And midway through, I got called to the snack bar. The old days, they'd do an announcement over the audio of the movie, and they would, so-and-so, come to the snack bar. So it was, "Bob Snedden, come to the snack bar, please." And what was up with that? So I went to the snack bar, and it was a couple of the friends of my date, who is now my wife, who just were there, and they were just there to remind me that to be nice. And of course, she was embarrassed because somebody was meddling in that. But it was fun. The small town stuff, a lot of fun.
Yeah. Which is that's kind of great about being a part of KCST is you got to continue that small town stuff. You covered the lost child. What were some of the other really, not so much, your favorite stories, but what you would consider the biggest news stories that you actually got to cover that came out of Florence?
Wow. I don't have much of a short-term memory. So that's a really good question. I could go back and search through my files. That's a really good question, and I've just drawn a blank, but I'm trying to think of some of the things that we did. Some of the blue-green algae blooms, and this wasn't necessarily a favorite, but this is notable. Sometimes, in Silcoos Lake, there'd be a blue-green algae bloom. And that impacted recreation. A lot of people get their drinking water out of Silcoos Lake. And just how that tied in with other, that wasn't something that was unique just to Silcoos Lake or just to the Florence and Dune City area. And anytime I cover something like that, I tried to make those ties that this is a much larger issue than just what's affecting us here right now. Conversely, we would run into things where if it was a national story, and I'll give you a case in point, the Sandy Hook shooting, the elementary school, there was no direct tie to Florence, but one of the first things that I did while that was going on was I called the folks at the CISO school district, and I wound up talking with a few of them over there, how does this affect you guys? And how does it make your kids feeling, and how does it make your staff feeling, and how do you deal with these? And there were some pretty emotional conversations that I had that I, you know, had to, that I got to share with some of the listeners about something that happened 3,000 miles away from here, did not have any direct impact, but nonetheless did have an impact because, you know, we're all dialed in globally, and those things do, even though we didn't know those people personally, you know, you felt like you knew them. Same way with the Umpqua Community College shooting a couple of years ago. And it really hit home with me when I realized that one of the young men who was killed in that, you know, one of my favorite things to do and has been to do that I'm continuing is to broadcast high school football and basketball games. And I'm looking through the list of the people who were shot and killed in Roseburg at Umpqua Community College. And there was one name that was popping up that looked familiar, and I realized he went to Sutherland High School, and I had called his name out many, many times at basketball games when I was broadcasting them. So, you know, you see what happened in Sandy Hook with all those elementary kids and young kids and the impacts it had, and you see it here in Oregon and the impacts it has, and you realize that everybody's got a connection one way or another. So, but I tried to take those types of stories and turn them into, okay, how does this affect us locally? And I also tried to tell the story about, okay, this happened there. What are we doing here to prevent or respond to something like that if it were to happen in our community? And Tom Turner, local police chief, or the new police chief, and he's been here for 3 or 4 years now, former Lane County sheriff, Tom brought it, and not just Tom, but before him, they were bringing it up at the Florence Police Department, the city of Florence, and working on security issues with SISO school district. So I was able to take something that happened tragic somewhere else and talk with local people about it and share that, about how we're preparing for that sort of thing and responding for that sort of thing. So I did have one story that went national, a couple of stories that went national that I reported on, and one of them came from the guy that's sitting in the desk I'm sitting at right now. You know, as your listeners may not know, you know, when I stepped away from radio, I had another life opportunity, and I took it, and I'm managing Roby's Furniture and Appliance here in Florence, and so mattresses, furniture, appliances, all kinds of stuff. It's a retail sales culture and something I've been in before. It wasn't something I was looking for, but it's been about 10 or 11 years ago, on a rainy winter day, Dustin Herring, who was sitting, used to manage the store here, they looked out on the highway, and there was a mama duck and a whole bunch of baby ducks trying to cross Highway 101, two lanes each direction with a refuge lane in the middle. And they went out and helped get mama duck off the highway and the baby ducks off the highway and get them all together in a box. And they took them several blocks away to a vacant area and let them go. But I talked to Dustin, interviewed him at his story, and it was one of those things that national news wires were quiet that day, I guess, and it picked up and went national. And so Dustin was getting phone calls from, you know, radio producers in Portland and on the East Coast and wanted to talk to him about that. And one of the biggest things I got was, did you get pictures? And I'm like, well, I'm radio. I didn't know I didn't get pictures.
Yeah. So it looks like, Robin, do we have somebody holding with a question for Bob?
Uh-oh.
I believe we do. We'll go ahead and just bring him on live.
All right.
All right, caller, you're on the line with Bob and Jay Bolchevich.
Oh, and they dropped as soon as you put them on the show.
All right. Well, caller, if you want, give us a call back. If you just want to listen, do not press 1. And a reminder to people that do want to give us a call, 646-721-9887. You can listen live. And if you do want to join us on the program, again, just press 1. It gives you instructions when you call, and we'll bring you online. And anyways, back to Bob and Jay.
Yeah. Thanks, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
Sorry about that, Bob.
That's all right.
Robin is my, Robin is my call screener and producer extraordinaire. And, you know, through the miracles of the internet, I'm sitting here in my home in Elmira broadcasting. She's in her home in Springfield producing the show. And you're down in at Roby's Furniture in Florence as our guest.
That's
so.
Right. Yeah.
Just amazing.
And I never had I never had a Robin in all the years of doing Our Town. I did have there was some on-air production assistance and occasionally somebody to route calls, but for the most part I did the vast majority of it all by myself, and it was it could be a little challenge sometimes. So. I can remember when I first started doing that program back in 98, 99, it was an early experience. I'd ask a question, and my guest was answering, and I got distracted and was just looking out the window, and next thing I know, there was silence because the question had been answered, and I wasn't paying any attention, and I had no idea where we were at or what we were talking about at that point, so,
One of those sinking moments, So,
after that, I decided I need to pay attention.
I bet. Yeah. Life lesson learned in that moment. What were some of the weirdest stories you covered? I mean, ducks crossing the highway making national news is pretty weird. But was there anything else really on the strange and bizarre side that you covered during your 18 years?
Yeah, I know there were, and once again, you know, I'm not very exciting in this regard because I can't think of it because there's so just the sheer volume. I did a newscast. Actually, we aired them six times a day on two different stations, but three, four, or five stories a day, 5 days a week, for 16 years, so hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands and thousands of stories. And I honestly, I can't think of any examples to tell you about. I could probably go back and I did keep digital files of the last several years. I should, but they're all on a different drive that I'd have to plug in. I should have got those out and scrolled through them and looked at them. But I'm looking at things like, you know, odd house fire sometimes. Yeah. I can't think of any off the top of my head, though, but I know there were things that occurred, but I'm just kind of, basically, I'm a dull and boring guy, and don't know what to talk about most of
it. Yeah, don't know what to talk about, but you could probably fill an hour without any help.
Well, yeah, I did tell you yesterday when we were setting us up, you said, you know, I didn't have to stay and visit the whole hour if I didn't want to. And I said, well, we'll just talk until both of us run out of words. And your response to that was?
Yeah, we would be there for a long time. Because both of us have the ability. Both of us have the ability to talk.
Yeah, and, you know, you can give me a topic and I can fill it in for you. We've had I've seen a lot of changes in Florence over the years, not just in the last 16 years with the radio station, and I think that was what helped me do my job, because I have seen so many changes, and I knew the backstory on so many different things, and I'm sure that people get tired of me saying about, you know, they would bring up something about maybe a particular building or a particular policy in town, and I would say, well, yeah, you know, they used to do it this way, and then somebody decided they wanted to do it this way, or this business was in that building, and then they moved out to another one over here, and so that one was vacant for a while, and then it housed this. And my favorite was always somebody moved to town, and I'd ask them where they're living, and they'd tell me where they live, and I'd say, oh, that used to be so-and-so's house. And they would just look at me like, okay, no, I'm not going to stalk you.
That's funny. So, you know, one of the issues, you know, you talked about WeLog earlier, how many tsunami warnings and actual tsunami
surges did you cover over 16 years, do you think?
Oh, that's a really good question. And actually, I'll go back further than that. I heard a news story today about the 1964 Alaska Good Friday quake. Was mm-hmm. one that really focused Americans or the U.S. on the geophysics of the Earth in our area. And, of course, that was it was an earthquake that caused a major underwater landslide near Anchorage, did a lot of damage in Anchorage, but it triggered a tsunami wave that came right down the West Coast and killed, I think, two or four people who were camping on the beach near Nearport, including some children, and then killed six or eight people in Crescent City, California. And that was the first one that people really were aware of, I think, in modern history. And they're like, oh, but that really got scientists focusing on, oh, this sort of stuff can happen. But the first one happened, I think it was in 06, December 26th, the Indonesian quake. You remember that one? Mm-hmm. You were out here on the West Coast that time, weren't you? That triggered the modern, was it 05 or 06? Anyway, it's about 12 years ago. That was the first one. And then from there, about 6 months later, there was a misfire of a tsunami warning that turned out to be accidental triggering that got a lot of people up excited about it. And then there were a few more. I think we've had two or three that I can recall, including one about 5 years ago that didn't ever really materialize here, but did wind up doing quite a bit of damage down in Brookings. That was after the Fukushima quake, which was about, 5 years ago, I think it was now. And never really materialized here, but that got a lot of people's attention. You know, most of them don't result in anything, and people don't really understand it. It's a very inexact science in trying to predict something like that or what is actually going to happen. But I've seen every bit of reaction from when the warning goes out and says, you know, stay away from the beaches. Go to high ground if you live or are in an area near a beach or an inundation zone, and that instantly brings people out who first thing they do is go to the beach because they want to see it. And I'm thinking, you know, I've seen videos. I don't think I'd want to do that. There was one many, many years ago. It was a tsunami warning, and people lined the bridge. I guess they wanted to see that wave coming up the river. I'm like, no, I don't think so. I'll go over here up on this hill and wait.
Yeah.
But the responses, different responses of people over the years have been pretty interesting about how they prepare for it. And that's one of the big changes I saw over the past decade and a half was how people are prepared much more, and they talk much more about tsunamis and earthquake preparedness than they ever did. I remember when it was first being talked about publicly, getting a lot of attention, there were a lot of people who didn't want to talk about it because they were afraid it would scare off visitors, and they would not come here because they'd be afraid of getting caught in a tsunami or an earthquake. And then I think the more rational people said, no, we just need to talk about it and be upfront about it so people are prepared if they do come. They're going to come anyway. And we're going to be doing a great disservice if we don't prepare ourselves and if we don't let other people know what to do if they encounter something like that while they're here.
Yeah, and to be truthful, people are more likely to come if they feel like the community they're coming to is preparing for the natural events that might overtake that community. You know, how many people would go to any place that suffers earthquakes regularly if they didn't know that they were paying attention to building codes and all that? You know, you kind of avoid those areas that don't have a building code and are also earthquake.
Yeah, Or telling people when you check into a motel, and there's some motels in Florence that do this, and they're very thorough about it. If you check into the motel, the Riverhouse Inn is one that I know for sure. That's right down on the river, and when you check in, you get tsunami evacuation information right then and there. So that if, you know, something happens, rather than not preparing you, not warning you if something happens, and then you don't know what to do, they're telling you, hey, if this happens, you just get your stuff and walk uphill, or don't get your stuff, walk uphill. They've also been, that organization's also been a leader in business preparation, because they realize if something happens, all their business records are down in the inundation zone. So they have worked over the years to get record storage away from that location, and how they would continue in business after a large-scale earthquake and tsunami, and a lot of businesses in the community. Florence area has really, really been a model to a lot of other communities on the coast on how to prepare, not just for the immediate response, but for how to recover afterwards.
Yeah, I think they have too. I you know, since being a commissioner and also being an engineer and having that sort of be prepared, belt and suspenders, engineer sort of attitude, I've paid attention, and Florence community has been really good about recognizing the risks they have and trying to prepare for them, which is, you know, good to see and a healthy thing to see, and not talking about it because you're afraid it might scare off some tourists is probably actually working against you in some ways, because people aren't stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah. People know that the West Coast is susceptible to tsunami. You know, the New Yorker definitely put that out there, national news. But it's I think they've done a good job of, you know, with the blue lines on the roads and the other things they've done, where, you know, it's, you know, pretty well known how to, you know, where you have to go to get out of the inundation zone and you know, what to do when you hear the sirens, you know, the business continuity plans, offsite record storage. Yeah, that's all important things. Every business should be thinking about that.
Yeah. The local officials, local officials and WELOG members, which are the ambulance and fire and police agencies in the city and school district, all that. One other thing they have been very vocal about is, okay, we're talking about earthquake and tsunamis, but we're far more likely to suffer a significant storm in the wintertime. So, you know, we don't care the reason you put together a disaster preparedness kit. Just do it. And a lot of people have seen the earthquake and tsunami as a good reason, because it shocks them enough to say, oh, I need to be ready for that. But you're much more likely to go maybe 3 or 4 days without power in the wintertime because of a storm that's far more likely to happen than an earthquake or tsunami. So we need to be prepared for that sort of thing too.
Yeah, I think everybody in Eugene last winter that had prepared for maybe the big earthquake or something like that was pretty happy when we had that ice storm, that they might have done a little preparation, because there were people that didn't have power for 7 to 8 days in that one.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely. That's right. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Having some non-perishable food stuffs, alternate heat source, all that, you know, some water on hand. All those things are just important things to prepare. So
yeah,
getting down to about the last 5 minutes of the Bo's Nose Show here with my guest, Bob Snedden, former news director at Coast Radio in Florence. Anything else, you know, you want to tell my audience about, you know, your career there at Coast Radio? You know, just, you know, you talked about how the community's changed in Florence and all, you know, is there something about those changes, you know, what's, you know, some of the significant events, you know, like the spotted owl listing or anything like that, that you remember making major changes in your community?
Well, you know what, One of the things that I saw over the years, and I will point to a specific case in point, there's City of Florence had a grant from Oregon Department of Transportation. It was actually federal highway grant money that was going through ODOT. And it was to put a multi-use path along Rhododendron Drive, and it would have gone from the area from about 9th Street, which is over by Peace Harbor Medical Center, and then north on Rhododendron Drive through the Green Trees neighborhood and out towards the river. They'd received the grant to do the planning, and it was a long-term process. And it was a process that started off with a lot of community involvement, and then it kind of morphed over time. And by the time they're getting ready to do the construction, some of the people in the community said, "Hey, wait a minute, this isn't what we talked about 4 years ago." It was a great looking project, but it would have taken a lot of extra trees out along that, and it cost a lot of privacy for some people in that area. And just the reaction to people in the community when they realized that and how they got involved, and I'm not saying it was the city's fault for not keeping people involved, because more often than not, people lose interest or they don't pay attention and they don't see what's going on. And the people who remain that make the decisions and do the plans are acting, you know, with pure heart and, you know, with the interest of what they see the community wants or needs. But a lot of times if the community is not directly involved, it may not match what the community wants. And so I would see things happen where there'd be a process planning. In this case, with the extended youth path, the community got involved and vocal, and the project got changed and scaled back, and they came out with a really good alternative in the long run. But it caused a lot of community angst, and a lot of people were upset on both sides of the issue that it really didn't need to be if everybody just remains engaged and involved and pays attention.
Yeah, and in fact, on the 10th, I think, they're going to have the grand opening of that revised path project down there in Florence. I think they're going to
for the next project after that, because they completed the Highway 101 to 11th Street improvements that connect up with that. It's a good project all the way through. Yeah.
Yeah, it's an example of kind of people losing track of a project but ultimately once people got reengaged, they did, you know, change the project and it got back to what people originally thought it was going to be. So it's kind of
I've seen that sort of thing happen over the years. People would get engaged late, mm-hmm. you know, not pay attention until late. And I have seen a couple projects derailed over the years for that very specific reason. So. Yeah, I've seen all kinds of different plans for different things in the community that have never taken place, and some of them were pretty good, some of them weren't.
Yeah. Well, I even think there's a former county commissioner whose career was practically derailed over plans to, you know, which seemed like a good idea at the time, to get rid of some surplus county property. Across the river from Florence and sell it off to private ownership.
That certainly became an issue, or you'd say Parks wound up with that eventually, but yeah, you're absolutely right. Certain things that if you don't have enough people involved or people aren't really aware of what's going on, and it's everybody's responsibility, you know, from you as a county commissioner, you know that it's your job to get people involved and let them know, but you also know there's a lot of times you're talking to a blank wall because people just aren't listening or paying attention.
Bob, we got to wrap it up here. I really appreciate you coming on the Bo's Nose Show today.
All right, Jay.
Thank
you.
Thanks for being my guest. Hang on a minute. I'll talk to you after we get off the air here. Everybody, thank you for listening to the show.
All right.